Hi everyone, I'm Heidi Rogers, and this is Tell the Others. I wanted to create a place for meaningful conversation, life lessons, and parenting hacks. Sometimes I chat to interesting people, sometimes I answer questions about parenting or life stuff, and sometimes I just rant. These episodes are filled with stories and insights that made me say, ugh, I just have to tell the others. So let's dive in to hear what we can learn today. Hello everyone, thanks for joining us for another episode of Tell the Others. Today is a special episode for me because I get to chat to one of my besties and a fellow colleague, another therapist, Vanessa Preston. Hello, Vanessa.
Hello.
Vanessa and I go way back. We used to sit next to each other when we both worked for a counseling team that specialized in sexual abuse. And we sat next to each other and became best buds there. And then when we both moved into private practice, we've stayed sort of on the same trajectory of doing trauma work and working with families, parents, kids, whatever. And Vanessa started a few years ago to focus more on body image, the relationship with food, the relationship with the body that we all have, and has built some programs around that too. And I just thought it would be cool to have Vanessa on today because I think she's doing amazing work. And I think the programs and things that she runs are fantastic. And I've sent several of my clients into Vanessa's programs, and the feedback I've gotten is phenomenal and truly life-changing. And I think the relationship we have with our body and the relationship we have with food is everywhere. It permeates every minute of our day and is, you know, something that we deal with for the rest of our lives. And I wanted Vanessa to come on today, I guess, to enlighten us and share with us some things that are not my specialty, but are Vanessa's specialty. And I just think it's really important information. So anyway, thank you for being here. If you want to just start, I guess, with a little bit of your background, your story, and yeah, what got you into this work and how you got to this point, I guess.
Yes. Well, before we hit record, I'm just going to tell your listeners this because it makes me laugh. Every time I do an episode or like teach or something, I'm always so nervous. And we were laughing before we hit record because you're one of my besties and I'm in like my little closet that I've created to be this sound booth. But yeah, the nerves always get me. But so I'm Vanessa. I'm a therapist, like Heidi said. I also did a nutrition course that about 12 to 18 months over COVID. So I'm a nutritionist, but I don't practice as a nutritionist. I kind of just bring that knowledge into the body food group that I do. And so, yeah, I've specialized in treating trauma and complex trauma and anxiety as you do too, Heidi. But as you said, yeah, I've really started over the last couple of years to get more involved in the work around body image and something called intuitive eating that we'll talk about. I suppose what brought me into this work is a few things. One is all the years that I've worked with children, teenagers, and adults, like it's pretty heartbreaking to see specifically girls and women who are sitting with so much body shame and who think they're alone in that. And so I think seeing my clients over the years struggle in this area. And then, of course, I have my own lived experience with some of this. I had my daughter at quite a young age. Teenage Vanessa went through some shit. But I had her quite young. And I think that's really the onset of my own eating disorder and my own body shame. Because at such a young age, I all of a sudden had this like post-pregnancy body that no one really informed me about, right? Like our bodies change, which is normal. Such a young age, kind of transitioning to, like I said, post-pregnancy body, and then having friends who, you know, 17, 18, 19 years old, I really fell into lots of shame and feeling like there was something wrong with me. And so, like I said, I have lived experience of this stuff. So I know how hurtful it can be. And I also know if it's not healed, I know the consequence it can have on our children. And so it's a little bit of what I've observed clinically in my practice. And then, like I said, my own lived experience in terms of what's really developed my passion around this.
I think it's one of those things where, like, when you figure stuff out, or like when a person figures something out, it almost feels like a compulsion that you want to go share with everyone and almost like shout it from the rooftops. You're in pain. You're suffering. It doesn't need to be like this. Look, look, look over here. I found a way. I found a method, a strategy, a technique, a belief, a philosophy, whatever. I figured something out that helped me. And now I don't have to suffer as much as you are. Like, look, look, come over here. That's how I feel with like therapy and stuff like that. Like,
yeah,
it doesn't need to be so painful. And it sounds like what you're saying is you felt the same with your own experience of going, whoa, you had to like unlearn all these things about the body and unlearn beliefs about thinness and fatness and health that even means. And then in your process is then when you went, oh my gosh, I was suffering so much and I don't need to suffer like that. And I want to tell the world. Yeah.
Yeah. And there is a freedom on the other side of this work that you really have to experience for yourself, but absolutely it. And you know, the group work that I do, I'm sure we will talk about, but it's one of the most deeply rewarding things in my career is watching women that do my group work and the way that they transform and shift. They often come in with, like I said, so much body shame and all of these kind of thoughts and beliefs about themselves that they're sort of defective in some way. They often come in with a long history of dieting, maybe a history of eating disorder. And it's really amazing to see this like group shift some of that, right? And I always say, again, I think you have to experience it to know exactly what I'm talking about, but ditching dieting, healing your relationship with exercise, healing your relationship with your body, it frees up so much headspace that this natural thing, and I know you've seen it with the clients that you've sent my way, this natural thing starts to happen. This like ripple effect of, I have head and heart space now to pursue what is actually important to me. My head is not full of keto and paleo and counting my calories and carbs and have I entered it into my app and have I exercised and have I been good or have I been bad? Am I on the diet wagon? Am I off? Like free from that. So like I said, you kind of pursue like what is actually important to me in this one life.
I was just thinking I wanted to share what some of my clients that I've sent your way have said. I was just looking up their quotes because I asked them afterwards, I'm just curious, what did you get out of Vanessa's program? And when I read them, it was like, they have no reason to lie to me. Like why they, you know, I didn't care.
Yeah.
But when I read what they wrote me, I was like, my head exploded. Cause I was like, I think if I didn't know these people, I would guess that they were lying because it sounds so transformative. It's like, I think a lot of people believe that's not possible for me, or like, I can't even fathom having that relationship with my body or food. This one kills me. I'm experiencing something I didn't think was possible. The amount of time I used to spend worrying about food and what I'm allowed to eat, that just doesn't happen anymore. There is freedom around food now. The freedom gives me choices. It gives me time back. I feel normal. I don't feel trapped anymore. I learned how to nourish my body and not punish it. I don't think about food anymore like I used to. It was just, and that's two people in that quote. And then another person said the same, and another person. They all have come back saying the same stuff. And it's so cool to me because food and our bodies is literally, it's an hourly issue. You have to eat, you know, like when people talk about, I've had clients before that with eating disorders that have said alcohol addiction is different, or pornography or gambling, or when you struggle with something like that, you don't have to consume that. It doesn't have to be in your everyday life. You can avoid the bar, but food is, you need it to survive and it's in your life hourly. And I've always thought like that's such a great point, and it makes it so hard because it's so complex. It's also then it's in culture, it's in your families, it's in your ethnicity, like body and your relationship to food is so much deeper than a beer, you know? Well, I mean, that also goes into culture and stuff, but yeah, I just think it's so cool because when you're dealing with something that is in your every hour of your life, the fact that you have, like I said to you earlier, you have the antidote in your pocket, and it is so frustrating when you meet people that they're suffering and you're like, I have the antidote in my pocket here, please take it. And they're like, no, I'm good. You know, because they can't fathom that there's a possible change out there, you know?
Yeah. And I have lots of compassion for people who kind of can't fathom another way, because we are in a culture that kind of feeds that. And, you know, if I think about what feeds into and what shapes our body image and what shapes our relationship with food, I have a graphic that I share in my group where it's like the person in the middle, and then there's kind of different circles around them. And so kind of this wider circle is cultural messages that we get around food and body. And in that is something called diet culture, and something that people either refer to it as anti-fat bias or fat phobia, which I can unpack. There's patriarchy, which is really this idea that women are really, we're objectified. We are supposed to look a certain way. Like, we are conditioned to know that from such a young age. It used to be more through magazines. Now it's so much more through social media. But there's all these systems that we internalize messages from over the years. And as you said too, our family system. So many people come to me with, specifically moms, who have a long history of body shame and dieting themselves. And it's this generational thing of this kind of dysfunction is passed down and taught. And sometimes, obviously, like, not even explicitly taught, right? And in terms of when I say diet culture, if that's new to some of your listeners, when I say that, I mean this like multi-billion-dollar industry that profits from people's body shame, really. And it is this, it's this system that sends us messages that all of our happiness and health will be found through thinness, right? It glorifies weight loss at all cost. And so often, you know, it's this thing in our culture where it's like, oh, you look great, you've lost weight. And I never comment on someone's body in that way, because we could potentially be complimenting an eating disorder, but also it sends a message of you weren't as good when you were fatter, you know? And so diet culture is a big part of why we kind of think and feel the way we do about our bodies. When I say fat phobia, like, that's something else not a lot of people are familiar with, but it's really these, again, messages that we've internalized around being fat and that it's bad. Think about how fat people are portrayed in the media, right? Cartoons, movies, they're either like the mean one or they're kind of like the silly, goofy one who's like eating everything, right? And like I said, these ideas that they're lazy, things like physical spaces that aren't accommodating to all body sizes. And that includes medical equipment, right? So fat phobia runs, this could be a whole episode in and of itself. You know, it runs deep in our culture, in our minds, and in the medical system. And so, you know, the other thing I see happen, you can tell me if you see this happen in your clinical work, but we can scapegoat our bodies. And so there can be sort of chaos or hurt or pain or suffering in our lives. And we kind of just all blame it on our bodies. Like, we think, if I could only get smaller, you know, fill in the blank, then I'll feel better. I'll feel confident. I can pursue my business dream, right?
But the number of times that I've heard clients say, I know that if I lost weight, I would have gotten the job. I know that if I lost weight, he wouldn't have broken up with me. I know if I had a better body or I lost the weight, I would have more confidence. And then that confidence is what would enable me to get the job or go on dates. And I'm just like, no, but, or if I get the boob job, that will, and the irony that always, and everyone knows this, I've had the clients that have then got the boob job, got the nose job, lost the weight, and it doesn't actually change. And I don't then get the job or get the boyfriend or the whatever. It's always, and most people will often say to me, when I was at my thinnest is when I was actually the most unhappy. And it's like this lie that our brain and our culture tell us that when this blank X fill in the blank, you know, when that is achieved or done, then I will be happy. And it's like, no.
Yeah. I call it like postponing our happiness, you know? And yeah, so I see that of things getting blamed on our bodies. And I think too, pursuing weight loss or dieting or always trying to fix our bodies, one, there's never an end point, right? Like what you said, I'll get the boob job, I'll get whatever. There's never an end point. Two, changing yourself physically is not going to address those deeper mental, emotional sort of issues going on. And, you know, I do think dieting can be like something we that provides us with a false sense of control or structure. So it can be a coping mechanism for deeper issues, you know, shame, trauma, attachment issues. And so it's tricky territory. And again, this is work I do in my group of like really starting to heal our mind space and our heart around this stuff with weight loss on the back burner.
A thing that I see a lot, I don't know what the stats are on the correlation between anxiety and eating disorders and chronic dieting, but I feel like a lot of my clients that have, that I've worked with that have had eating disorders have anxiety issues like at the core, you know, that it's like when you just said that whole, it provides a false sense of control. So if we know that the crux of anxiety is times when I feel uncertain, uncomfortable, and a lack of control, right? That's the trifecta that equals anxiety. Then it's like, well, if I can be really rigid and strict in my diet and I can control what I eat, that makes me feel a sense of certainty, comfort, and control. And so that just underlying, like, that's existence, man. Like, that's life. That is the basis of life. And I think with COVID, that's like just exasperated that. And that's been so much more of a thing because there's been such a lack of certainty, comfort, and control with living through a pandemic. I would love to see the research in 20 years about the impact of the pandemic on body image and food and diet and eating and stuff, because I think it would have skyrocketed during the pandemic, right? Because if my whole environment, if everything around me is uncertain, uncomfortable, and lacking control, well, what can I, oh, where is it? Where is it? How can I find certainty, comfort, and control? Food. Perfect. And then it's like, that is such a common way that I can then, oh, I got the power back. Now I have certainty. Now I have control. Now I have comfort. And I'm getting it all through food. And it often is a great sort of adaptive response to like when you're in a crazy environment, right? Like, and for both of us having worked in trauma for such a long time, we know the connection to that, right? That when I'm in a chaotic household or a stressful childhood or a stressful teenagerhood, to know that I can always rely on food, oh, that's where I can find my certainty, my comfort, and my control. And so many clients I've worked with say like, oh my gosh, that was such a light bulb moment, Heidi, when we put that together, of realizing how much when I was a little kid or a teenager, because my parents weren't around or my parents were unsafe or my parents were just whatever, stressed and doing, you know, dealing with their own crap, that I relied on food as a comfort and a support because it brought me all those three things. And those three things don't make you crazy or weird. It's like everyone's brains wants those things. That's everyone's amygdala, man, that is just constantly seeking certainty, comfort, control, certainty, comfort, control. The brain just, that's its natural state, is wanting those three things. And food is like brilliant because it satisfies all those. And then you can get into the chemical stuff of dopamine and oxytocin, you know, but really we learn from a little age that food is really soothing and food provides a lot of certainty, comfort, and control.
Yeah. I could go on a bit of a tangent on a few things that you just brought up, but there's a few things. One is the idea of emotional eating, again, this could be a whole podcast in and of itself, but eating really is outside of the attachment with our primary caregiver. Eating is our first coping mechanism. You think about it, baby is born. What do we want it to do? We want it to eat, right? And so, you know, but I think that's beautiful. That might be hard to hear for some people who are feeling lots of stress and anxiety with food right now. But I think emotional eating can be this absolutely beautiful gift of, it is a coping mechanism and that is okay. It can teach us when we're needing something. We can learn different ways to meet that need in addition to food. And so I really like what you said about the, with food being a very normal coping mechanism. The other thing I was going to say, kind of back to, just because I don't want to leave it unsaid, but back to where you said, like, someone's like, I didn't get the job because I'm fat. I do want to say there's complexity here, because there is something called weight stigma, where it's very related to kind of fat phobia and anti-fat bias. But weight stigma, it does show us that fat people are less likely to get the job and get hired, or they are more likely to be paid less. And so it's kind of, the way I view this is, I work with individuals to make peace with themselves inside this really messed up kind of system. And I give them a safe place to do that work. We can reject so much of what we've been taught. Like you said, we can unlearn. But I also want to validate, if you have a listener going, yeah, but seriously, and they have experienced weight stigma, that's real. And so it's kind of this, it's always, I know we work the same with this, it's always starting with compassion and validation of your experience, and then kind of walking forward to unlearn what we need to. The other thing you were describing with that, like using food as this like source of control, the tricky thing with that is it's only sustainable for so long. And so there's something called the restrict binge pendulum. And this is talked a lot about in intuitive eating, where the pendulum swings to restriction, where we go, we're dieting, where we have all these food rules. We can't have this or that. This is bad. This is good, right? We kind of move into that restriction. Our body fights back against that from a survival standpoint, right? It perceives that it's unsafe. It perceives almost a famine. And it freaks our bodies out. Like, it puts our bodies under a lot of stress. And so what normally happens is eventually we swing into the binge, the pendulum swings to the binge side. And that's where we overeat. That's where we eat past fullness. That's where binging can happen. And that's where lots of shame and things like that can set in. And what intuitive eating does is we kind of stop that pendulum from swinging. And people think it's, you know, the binging is bad. The binging is, to me, part of like your body looking out for you. It is life-saving. It's going, I'm not getting enough and I need more, right? And so kind of stopping that pendulum in the middle with intuitive eating, where this takes time, but learning to tune into our hunger cues and our fullness cues, and actually learning what food satisfies us, learning to cope with our emotions with compassion and tools, including food and others, right? And so those are the few things I wanted to kind of at least hit on that you had brought up.
Yeah, I think it's important for people to realize that your body's not out to get you. Your body is not the enemy. Your body is not like, I'm going to make you crave crap. I'm going to make you crave that quote unquote bad things. There's always a reason. Like, it knows what it's doing. And if you are, you know, low or deficient in something, you suddenly are going, I'm really craving carrots. You know, I'm really craving carbs or whatever. It's like, there's a reason, and getting curious about what that is. You know, you think about pregnant women and how they're like allowed to have these really random cravings, and they're allowed, quote unquote, to honor them if they want to eat pickles and ice cream, or they want to eat 20 potatoes or whatever. It's like, oh yes, girl, you are building a baby and you need to just nourish your body. And it's like pregnant. I mean, that's a whole nother podcast episode about what happens there? Like with pregnancy, and so many women have said to me that their pregnancy changed in a beautiful way, transformed their relationship with their body and was really healing in celebrating and loving what my body was capable of. And, but then as soon as the baby comes out, then I'm back to hating it because now I have all this extra weight. I watched the documentary you've been telling me about, Embrace. Watched that last night. Yeah. That's exactly what she said was, as I loved my pregnant body. And then as soon as the baby came out, I was looking down at this blob, you know, of my skin and my belly and was then just horrible to myself. Anyway. Yeah. I think the shifting in realizing that my body is craving stuff for a reason, and I need to kind of listen to my body more and be more in tune and connected to it rather than whipping it, you know, and always punishing it and earning my food. And if I have that piece of cake, I have to go for a run to earn it. Or, oh no, I can't possibly have a cookie because I didn't go for a run earlier, or that kind of crap of just punishment, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. There's a whole principle about making peace with food within the intuitive eating framework that I teach. And this part can kind of sound really scary. And I want to normalize that. Before I went on my own sort of healing around this, I wanted to punch someone when they said what I'm about to say. Like I really did. I was like, you don't, that might work for some people. It does not work for me. You don't know me kind of thing. But there's, and it is done gradually. And I do think it's better done with the support of a group environment or at least a clinician, but it's called habituation. And what we know is that the more we say foods are off limits, and I used to do this all the time, I can't have certain foods in the house because I'll binge, right? And so I would go, I can't have them in the house, problem solved. But then it left me kind of driving home from work, stopping at the petrol station, getting all kinds of the foods that I had not allowed in my house and binging and feeling like shit. And so the habituation is we go on this methodical process of inviting some of those foods back in. And like I said, I think that's best done with support, but our brains kind of get this message that, oh, you mean I can have a cookie when I want? I can have it as part of my lunch? You mean it's not off limits? You mean I'm not going to guilt and shame myself for having this? And what happens is our brains move out of that scarcity sort of mindset. And we really know, and I don't just mean know in our heads, we know that this food is no longer forbidden or off limits. And it is this paradox where it's like, and now I feel like I have some control with this. So it's, that's one thing I see often is, and I see people do it with their children of like, well, we just won't have those quote unhealthy bad foods in the house. It can often just lead to preoccupation with that food. It can lead to secret eating. It can lead to shame. So it really is like intuitive eating is this framework where we make peace with all foods, right? And I'll say like a little bit more that intuitive eating is a framework that was developed by two dietitians because what they saw is they're doing this status quo thing of like, limiting, you know, intake of calories and giving meal plans. They'll see short-term weight loss, but long-term they see shame, disordered eating, weight gain, right? And so they developed this to support people to get out of that cycle. And there's over 100 research studies. There's more and more research coming out about intuitive eating and the benefits of it. And so it's really a game changer. But I want to say, sometimes on social media, it's simplified. So people think it's just like, oh, you mean I just listen to my hunger and my fullness and the end. Totally.
Not that basic. Not that basic.
Yes, there's complexity. It's best to have support when you do it. And so, yeah, there's misconceptions with it, I would say. It's not sitting around and all we do is eat pizza and donuts. You know, it's not like forgetting about, you know, just ditching health altogether. There's real misconceptions around it.
When I first learned about intuitive eating, it was on a Glennon Doyle post on Instagram. And Glennon has what, like probably close to 2 million followers. And she posted something about her past eating disorder history. and that she's, you know, can't believe at her age that she still is battling these demons. And I wish that I wasn't. And it's just, essentially she was like, it's just so hard. And does anyone have any thoughts on what's worked for you? And my mind was blown when I looked at the comments, and I don't know what percentage, but it was some, it felt like to me 80% of the comments were just like intuitive eating, intuitive eating, intuitive eating. All these people saying intuitive eating changed my life. Intuitive eating is the only thing that's worked. And I know it's Instagram and that's not scientific research, but still it was interesting to just see how many people were replying that intuitive eating changed my life. So where do you want to start on unpacking that? Because I think for the average person who hears this, they're like, well, I know what intuitive means. I know what intuition means. I know what eating means. So that just must mean, like you said, I just eat pizza. If I, you know, wake up and I'm like, I want cookies. I'm having cookies for breakfast because I'm going to follow my intuition. And it's like, nope, it's a little bit more than that. And obviously, if it was that simple, you and I wouldn't have jobs and, you know, the diet industry wouldn't be what it was if it was that simple. So do you want to break down, yeah, the basics of intuitive eating for people who are curious to unpack that?
Well, so it's definitely a weight neutral approach to eating. So it very much is weight loss on the back burner. We're not pursuing that. And it's not just instincts. That's where I think people are like, if I give myself permission to eat all foods, I'm only going to eat quote junk food. I was scared of that for a long time, but it's really not what happens. Can you imagine eating only, I don't know, donuts three times, like every meal? Like it would get, you get sick of it real quick. But intuitive eating is like this interplay of instincts, our emotions, our thoughts, our body sensations. And what I love about it is it's reconnecting to this inner wisdom that I think we've lost. Like we reject the diet mentality. And that again can take some time and be a gradual process, but rather than sourcing out expertise about our bodies to some Google search or the next fad diet or some intuitive eating influencer or celebrity who promises that they're like weight loss lollipops or the cure, we reclaim our own inner wisdom and we go inward to understand what works for us. And that's powerful. And I do think that's the part that spills into other areas of our lives. And I've referred to principles. We look at, again, so I've already kind of named all of them, but another part, there's two that I haven't really, but one is movement. And so when we have really struggled with dieting and with weight and body image, often there's dysfunction there with exercise and body movement, because we can either just ignore exercise because nothing we do feels like enough or good enough, or we can use it to punish our bodies or compensate. So like you said earlier, if I enjoy this like holiday and eat the food, then I have to punish myself with intense exercise. And so part of intuitive eating too looks at creating some peace with body movement. And there is a gentle nutrition component where once we've kind of unlearned what we need to, we really learn some ways of using nutrition to support us, right? Again, it's not in the way I think we've all been conditioned to do.
I think of the number of clients that have said to me, when we've talked about what their exercise plans and stuff were, I have to do a Les Mills high cardio, I'm sweating my face off class at the gym to feel like I've really worked out. If I'm doing a yoga class and I'm not sweaty afterwards, well, that's not real exercise. Real exercise must be my heart rate gets to X for this many minutes and I am drenched in sweat. And that is what real exercise looks like. And I hate those classes, but it's all right, because I feel good afterwards that I've done some really great exercise. And what do you say to that? Like what, how would you respond to that? You know, the thing that I always say is you don't have to earn your food and you don't earn your worthiness or your value by how much or what exercise you do. You are worthy of belonging. You are worthy of love just as you are. And yeah, you don't have to earn your food by exercising. You know, you don't earn that cake or that piece of bread. Yeah. What do you say to that when people have this kind of, it's almost like a disordered relationship with exercise, you know, and movement. And I love too, just even calling it movement rather than exercise. I remember you telling me that once where I was saying like, oh, I really want to get back into yoga. And I've just really dropped off my yoga practice and stuff. And you were like, can you just start with movement? And I was like, oh yeah, it's so basic, but didn't think of that, you know? And you were like, why don't you just see about going for a walk, like, or just doing gentle stretching, you know, why does it have to be, I have to go to a yoga class. And I was like, yeah, I could just focus on movement and just moving my body. Huh? Yeah. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think exercise and movement for so many can be all about manipulating and changing their bodies. And there can be shame in that, right? The number of women I see, and in my own experience, you know, those gym challenges, for example, where you go hard.
Oh, I hate gym challenges.
4 to 8 weeks, you have a meal plan and you kind of stand at this on the scale at the end and you're either happy with the results and they don't last, or you're feeling shame and defeated that you didn't, you know, change as much as you wanted to. And so again, lots of this is peeling back the layers of why do you want to engage in movement, right? Why, if we remove the trying to physically manipulate your body for a moment, why? Is it mobility? Is it stress relief? Do you want to find something that you enjoy, right? So it's kind of, I think, connecting to why, and it's also being brutally honest with yourself. I was in denial for a long time that this intense form of exercise I was doing, I said I loved it for so long, I absolutely hated it. And so it took a while for me to be completely honest with myself. You know, you know that whole quote, it's hard to lie to the deepest part of yourself. Like, that's what it makes me think of, is you really have to get honest with yourself. And
how do you do that though? Like, how did you do that? Like, was that therapy or like, what, like age, like maturing, like what gets someone to that point of, well, I think that question is huge to go, why do I need to do this cardio class? Why am I going to boot camp? Why am I going for a run? What is that about? Cause one of the things that really motivates me is seeing my dad, who's almost 88, and he's fallen a few times and broken his hip and then been in hospital for months recovering. And he has no like physical fitness. He has no core strength. He's got nothing. And that is like legit. If I were to put a motivating photo on my fridge to like motivate me, it's that I don't want to be frail when I'm older and I want to be able to like play with my kids and my future grandkids. Do you know what I mean? Like that is my motivation is I want to just feel well. And so, okay. So that's me. Right. But then a lot of people would say, don't care about that. I just want to be skinny. I want to have a nice bikini bod for the beach in summer. You know, I think just asking that is why? Why am I doing this to myself? Why do I want to do this yoga class? Why do I want to do this? Great question. But to that point of what you just said of denial, how do we package that? How do we get someone to shift out of that?
Well, I think it's definitely a process. And my motto for everything is curiosity and compassion. And so if only the place that someone starts is curiosity of, I'm curious why I'm doing this. I'm curious if I enjoy it or if I don't, or what's my why? Really staying with that curiosity piece for a little while can be really helpful. And I think the other thing that can be helpful is we tend to have an all or nothing mindset around specifically exercise. Of, I see people create rules of, I have to do X 5 times a week, right? And then there's self-judgment if that doesn't happen. So something, again, it's a gradual process, but creating room for flexibility of kind of what you said. If there's a day where your body's just feeling really tired, it's kind of learning to tune in and go, what does she need? I call my body her. Because it brings an element of compassion. I would never be abusive or punitive to another her in my life. So why do I do it to my body? And so kind of going like, well, what is she needing today? Well, it might be gentle yoga. It might be a walk outside. It might be rest and reading a book. And so I think learning to tune in and create a bit more flexibility. And then the other thing that can help, it seems to really help, is thinking about what's already happening. We have this narrow view of what exercise is. It has to be in the gym. It has to be hard. It has to be intense. We have to be sweating. And really kind of backing away and going like, what movement's already happening? Is it like stairs that I go up and down in my house? Is it like the kids that I'm running around after at the park? Is it the laundry basket that I'm lifting all the time? So kind of already acknowledging ways that you are moving your body.
Yeah, I think it's a process though, isn't it? Because a lot of what you're saying, I'm feeling like sounds wild to a lot of people, right? Yeah. Like, well, so wild.
It's a paradigm shift.
Totally.
It is. And, you know, it is a paradigm shift. And that's why, like I said, that's why I'm a big fan of curiosity. And, you know, even thinking when it comes to food and body, like, or even exercise, do you want to be where you are in the next 10, 20, 30 years? Like, women I meet have dieted or tried to, you know, change and shrink their body since they were 8 years old. So it's like, it's lots to unpack, but I keep emphasizing this, but I don't want to overwhelm your listeners. It is this compassionate, gradual shift. It's not having to perfect it either. That's what I tell the girls and the women in my group, is diet culture is all about black and white thinking and perfectionism. Intuitive eating is collecting information about yourself over time.
Intuitive eating is collecting information about yourself over time. Wow.
Yeah. So there's no need to, like, I have to be a perfect intuitive eater. It just doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I like that you just pointed out was the whole thing of saying, I refer to my body as her, and it's sort of like a separate part of myself. And both you and I practice IFS, or internal family systems, which, for those that don't know, is also known as parts work. And it's a methodology or a type of therapeutic intervention that Richard Schwartz developed. And both Vanessa and I use it in our clinical practice and in our own brains. You know, the way that we sort of view all the voices in our head as different parts. And my clients are familiar with the language, the boardroom. That's how I refer to it, is it's the boardroom of Heidi and then all of the different board members within me. So I have anxious me, mom me, wife me, friend me, daughter, sister. So all the roles that we play. And then all of the different emotions and the feelings that I have. So angry me, anxious me, the me that feels she needs to look perfect and skinny and pretty and makeup. And then the part of me that's like, whatever, I'm going to wear trackies and Uggs and I don't care. And I'm going to relax. And there's all these different parts of me. And one of the things that really was interesting to me when I first read the IFS book that Richard Schwartz wrote, where he started with this whole system, the whole like method, was when he was working with eating disorder clients and how he found it was the most powerful method of intervention clinically. And I too have found, even eating disorders aside, with all my clients, I find that parts work or internal family systems, basically just separating out all the voices in your head as parts, right? There's a part of me that feels blah. There's a part of me that thinks this. There's also a part of me holding that kind of duality or that multiplicity, that there's all these different parts to me that can feel lots of different things at the same time. And that's okay. And then identifying, like, that is just a part of me. There is a voice in my head who just said, I can't have that piece of cake because I didn't go for a run yet. There is a part of me who also says, it's okay. It's food. It's okay to have that cake. There's a part of me that's worried about my weight right now. There's a part of me that's thinking about the trip we have coming up in the summer and having to wear bathing suit. There's a part of me. And you just sort of acknowledge all of these different voices and all of these different parts of me, and then start to what? So, like, what would you say if you're applying like parts work to our bodies or the way that we eat, how do you then what? So, okay. So I notice this part of me is saying, I can't have that cake because I've not gone for a run or whatever. Then what? What do you then do with the parts? How do you address that? Once I've been able to sort of address that Well, maybe that's even the first step, is I have to address and be aware and get curious about, I have to start there, that I have these different voices. And so do you like name them, you know, like we go, oh, that's Sally, and Sally is so obsessed with weight, you know, or that's diet me, or that's, because I think that's so huge, dude, to say my body is like a separate part. It's like, it's a separate entity, and you wouldn't speak or treat your body the way that you would your kids or a friend. How hard we are on our bodies, you know? Anyway, I've kind of asked 700 questions in that one, but where do you start with that?
Yeah, where do we start? I think, again, curiosity and awareness is key. And so when it comes to the way that we think about our bodies or food, becoming aware is a really important part. Lots of people that come through my program, they might say something like, I'm not dieting, I don't have food rules. By the end of it, they've identified food rules, right? And so you can kind of name that of like my diet culture part or my eating disorder part. And the trick really is, once we've become aware of it, we externalize it. That's such a big part, is going, that doesn't define us, right? So we can externalize it. And I like to use like an acceptance commitment therapy type visual of, I'm sitting at the back of a movie theater and I'm watching the thought, or I say story, go through on the screen, right? And the beauty is I can learn to observe it and really start questioning, is this helpful? Is this true? And is this kind? Is this consistent with my values? And what I say is, often the first thoughts we have are what we've been conditioned to think. Patriarchy, diet culture, family stuff, the school bully. This is how we've been conditioned to think. When we can create that pause and that curiosity, externalize and observe it, then we can come to an intentional thought of like, well, what does my healthy adult self say? Well, I want to be compassionate and give permission to enjoy this cake right now. So it's this process of externalizing, observing, and really reframing with some intention and more consistency with your value system. I hope that makes sense.
Permission, just that word just always jumps out at me, because I think that is such an issue. Like, permission to rest, permission to not be busy, permission to eat what I feel like eating, permission to listen to my body, permission to change the way that I've been conditioned to think. Like, do I want to believe the stuff I grew up with? Do I want to believe that stuff that like my culture has taught me? Do I want to believe and subscribe to what advertisers have told me is the mark of beauty and is the mark of health? Like, what does that crap even mean? You know, like,
and it is, it's pretty empowering when you start going, I reject that.
Yeah.
I'm worthy in my now body, regardless. You know, so there's power, but it takes a process to get there. The thing that I see often, and probably resonates with lots of your listeners, is people realize some of what's problematic when they have children, because all of a sudden we go, would I want my daughter in this position? Do I want my daughter to have this body image? Do I want my daughter to have this relationship with food? And it really is like this process where you kind of go, do I want this to happen with another generation? The body hatred, the body shame, the anxiety with food, the constant dieting, like, do I want that for my child?
The thing that kills me though, dude, about that is the denial that a lot of moms are in. I see, you would know what I'm talking about. I see this all the time. The denial that they are in, one, that they have a disordered relationship with their body or food, and the, I don't know, ignorance. I don't think it's intentional or, you know, manipulative or anything, but the total blindness to how much their shit is being projected onto their kid their disordered relationship with food and their body, and they don't even see it. Like, you don't know what you don't know, right? And so many parents don't even realize that the way that they, their relationship with food is so being brainwashed, projected, put onto their kid. And then when I might gently, you know, ask, like, what's your relationship with food like? You know, like, what's your relationship with your body and exercise like? And they're like, oh, no, no, no. I don't talk like that to my kids. Oh, no, no, no. I would never call foods good or bad, or I don't, no, 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 no. I never articulate that to my kid. I just think those things. And I'm like, bullshit. It doesn't work like that. You can't have these little separate compartments of the way that you think about bodies and food and what you believe is true in the world, and that, you know, thin bodies are good bodies and fat bodies are bad and sugar and, oh my gosh, it doesn't work like that. You cannot hold those beliefs and simultaneously be shielding and protecting your kid from those beliefs. It doesn't work like that. It will be coming out in subtle ways you don't even realize. It'll be coming out through little comments, or no, no, we can't have that much sugar, sweetheart. Or you might not even realize, you know, you leave a party and you say to your partner in the car on the way home, wow, Janet's really put on a few pounds. Did you notice that? Or gosh, Janet's skin doesn't look great. She looks like she's having, like, she looks really stressed. She looks really unwell. There's these little ways that you are planting seeds in your kid's head that bodies matter, appearance matters. Even, you know, oh, sweetheart, your outfit doesn't really match. Or, oof, that outfit, honey, you can't go out wearing that. That doesn't look great. Or, we need to fix your hair, sweetheart. You look like, you know, a feral cat, or you look like a homeless person, honey. We got to fix it. All of these subtle ways you don't realize you are making your kids think that appearance matters and your body is the most important thing. And what we put into our bodies is the most important thing. And it's, I want to shake people sometimes, honestly, when I feel like, you know, it doesn't work like that. You can't just think it. Your kids know, dude. If you have a screwed up relationship with your body or a screwed up relationship with exercise, they know. They know, they know, they know. They sense it. They can feel it. They might not know what it's called, depending on their age, but I guarantee you, you are starting to plant the seeds in them now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. And I think the denial piece can partly be because there is this generational thing of normalizing disordered eating and normalizing anti-fat bias. And so it's tricky because I see where, like I said, it's so normalized. And yeah, you're right that our kids will pick up even if we're not saying something explicitly. And the thing that I like to say, because I hear it often from women I work with, is it's too late for me.
Good one.
Or it's too late because my child is X years old. And I always say it's never too late. And, you know, I didn't do this work until my daughter was in her teens. She's turning 20 this year. I have so much compassion for women who are in this space. There's things that I'm unpacking now with my daughter because of some of my own traumas and behaviors. And of course, it wasn't intentional. But one of the things I say, and is in part of my own story, like I said, I would keep foods out of the house. So cookies, chips, lollies, candy, depending on where you are and what you call it. And so my daughter would have to hide her stuff in a drawer in her bedroom. Because it was like, and I just think about what message that sent her. You know what I mean? And so I like to normalize, it's hard to start opening your eyes to what your actual relationship is like with body, food, and movement. Yeah. And it's never too late.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. What would you say for people that are kind of hearing this, and I'm sure that a lot of, we'll both probably get feedback from people going, my brain was exploding during that episode, because I know when you and I first started talking about it years ago, that I was like, what? Like thin privilege? What does that mean? Fat phobia? What? Wait, I thought BMI was the mark of health. What? Like when you started kind of teaching me this stuff, where do we start? Like for a parent who's hearing this going, whoops, whoopsie, I'm hearing these things. I'm feeling a little confronted, or I'm feeling a bit shamey that like I've been so crazy with my kids about sugar and pizza and bad foods and good foods. And oh my gosh, I didn't realize I was doing this. You know, where like compassion, obviously you and I teach compassion is the foundational pillar of everything. But after compassion, where do they start? Like listening to your podcasts, you know, like a book, like where does someone start when they realize, whoa, I think I have some stuff to unlearn? Where, because I feel like a lot of the stuff we're saying is like, it might be overwhelming for people that we're saying so many things that are such a deep shift of what they believe. Where should they start in this journey?
Yeah. And it is funny because we're kind of giving like an overview of body image and an overview of intuitive eating and kind of challenging some ideas that we tend to hold in our culture. And so it is funny because normally it would be like a tiny little part of this as an episode, where me and you are looking at like the bigger picture. So,
yeah.
But I think, like you said, compassion and being open to starting your own work. You know, yes, I have my group program. Yes, I have a podcast that we can put in the show notes. That's great. Start reading, start listening. And I would say, keep an open mind. Yeah. And I think keeping an open mind, we can put some resources also in your show notes for people. I will say though, reading in the area of body image and intuitive eating, there's some fabulous books, but there's something different about doing it in a group or with a therapist or even a dietitian, someone, because to embody the work is different than just kind of like reading and intellectualizing it. And so, yeah, we can put some of my resources in the show notes.
What book would you say, if we have readers, you know, who are listening, what book would you say is a good starter point, a good basic, you know, Evelyn Tribole's intuitive eating book, or would you say Lindo Bacon, or what, who would you say is one of your favorite places to start with books? For the readers that are listening.
I do think Lindo Bacon, they have a few books now, but Health at Every Size is a good one because, okay. I mean, it's a little bit hard to read because some of it is like research, but it really dives in. And for the people that want the data, that's a good book. A book by Christy Harrison, it's called Anti-Diet. That's a good one to read. And yeah, the intuitive eating book is good, but I hear this all the time that, yeah, it's good. I read it. Now what?
Like, yeah.
How do I do this?
Yeah. It's a lot of information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sonia Renee Taylor.
Okay.
She has a book called The Body Is Not an Apology.
Ooh,
she also, it's a fabulous title. She also did a podcast episode with Brené Brown. So if you're kind of more of like a learn by listening, the podcast with Sonia Renee Taylor was good. I'm just going to open my Audible because
you'll get,
I feel like,
there. Well, we can just add them in the show notes. That's all right. I just thought for people who are like me that would go, I'm never going to look at the show notes. Just tell me now.
There's another one, More Than a Body.
Okay.
So they're twins, Lindsay and Lexi Kite, and they both kind of went through and did their PhD around body image stuff. And
what's the book title again? Sorry.
More Than a Body.
More Than a Body. Okay. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is the list that we had talked about of when parents say, I don't want my kid to have the same relationship with their food and their body that I do. Those five things that you had listed about, you know, do your own work. Could you just go through those five, that list? Because I think that's such a common question I get in the parenting program that I have when I work with parents, that just that I don't want my kids, especially the daughters. I don't want my daughter to have that same relationship with the world herself. Yeah. What would be the overview that you would say? If you're not going to read a book, you're not going to listen to another podcast episode. We have your attention for 5 minutes. These are the five takeaways that you can just start doing this stuff.
Okay.
What would those be? Yeah.
Well, so we've said one, which is you really do have to do your own work. And before we dive into these few kind of tips that you can implement today, right? I do want to let people know that eating disorders are the third most common chronic disease in children, right? And that's not talked about enough, because this whole kind of obesity epidemic is so just crushed into our minds. And I've worked with people who have lived this, but also I just want parents to think about for a moment with the overweight obesity thing, how a child must feel, right? How does a child feel when they're walking through school and there's some health challenge going on, or there's some poster about health and obesity epidemic, to know that their body is an epidemic? Like, that is one of the most shameful things I can imagine. Totally. And so keeping in mind, it is important to unlearn some of what we've been taught, again, around thinness, around fatness, around eating disorders, around obesity. And a few tips. One would be helping your child develop a critical eye with media, right? Like, and that might be when they're, even as they're getting older, right? We want to talk about the images on social media are fake. They are photoshopped, right? We want to explain images of your favorite celebrities, again, touched up, surgically enhanced. Like, we want to kind of give them skills to think critically about the images that are being shown to them. We want to create an environment where you aren't commenting on bodies, including your own. So the example you gave of like, oh, did you see so-and-so? She's really, you know, put on weight or whatever. We really need to stay away from commenting and objectifying people's bodies. That also includes praising weight loss, because when we praise weight loss, we are sending the message to our children that you are more worthy if you are thin. Yeah. And that you need to pursue that at all costs, even if it costs you your mental health. And so the other thing to be mindful of is what I talked about in terms of food rules that you're conveying to your child, because lots of food rules, restriction, obsession with healthy and not healthy food, in sugar, in quotes. Yeah.
Sugar thing. I see so many parents flipping out when their kids have sugar.
Yeah.
Or go to a birthday party and there's lots of sugary stuff, or when they're given candy, you know, at a school thing or friends on the playground or whatever, literally getting like angry when their kids are consuming quote unquote too much sugar. And it's like, what are you teaching your kids?
Yeah. And that is restriction. So that's totally a good point. Cause even if they're eating it at the birthday party, if there's all these comments about this is bad, you can only have one, right? You can only have one, that restriction. Again, it's painting the scene for things like guilt, shame, obsession, anxiety, scarcity mindset. And so when we make these things available, they kind of like aren't as exciting, right? Like, it's totally kind of like, and so the, and then another tip.
Sorry, before you go to the next one, I just want to say on that, one of the things that has helped a lot of parents that I've worked with when they've had like younger kids, like under 10, and they've told me some of these rules that the parents have around food and stuff like that, I'm like, dude, what is going to happen when your kid is 11 and 12 and starts going over to friends' houses and you are not there to monitor? I mean, that happens before 12, but you know what I mean? And they have a pantry full of crap and a full of junk food that you would never allow them to have or have in your house. What do you think is going to happen if you are not teaching your kids when they are younger around listening to your body? When do you think that starts? It doesn't just like poof, you're 15, you're 20, you're 40, and then you start doing that. It's teaching them now when they're little, listen to your body and what your body needs. And so when we're at a party, my kids, and there's 7,000 cupcakes and gummy snakes and, you know, all of that stuff, I am constantly telling them, listen to your body. For me, if I have 5 cupcakes, that makes my tummy hurt and I don't feel well and I don't feel like I can run. So that's what it is for me. I don't know what it is for y'all, but that's what it is for me. And I know that I have a limit of eating ice cream or cake or cookies or whatever, right? So it's like, you have to start teaching them that stuff when they're little, because you're not going to be around all the time. Like that's everything with life, is teaching them how to fly on their own and make the choices when you are not there. Yeah. And it's not about good choices, make good choices. No, it is about listening to your body, your instinct, your intuition, listening to yourself of what it is that you need and want, and knowing that you are worthy of 20 cupcakes or whatever. Like, it's not about that. I always say to parents, what is going to happen when they are 12 and they are at a friend's house?
Yeah.
And you're not there.
Something that you highlighted to me is your child's autonomy.
Yes.
And trust in themselves, right? So even if they go to the birthday party and they eat cupcakes and then they go, "Mom, my stomach hurts," that's not even the time to yes. The curiosity will be like, "That's curious, isn't it?" You know, and it's information gathering for them too, of like, "Oh, I know if I have too much lollies, stomach tends to hurt." You know, it's very much about autonomy. And when women are doing this work for themselves, that is a magic part of this, is we are restoring their own body autonomy that has been stolen. And so,
and that permeates into so many other parts of life, right?
Totally does.
I mean, you and I having such a long work experience in sexual abuse, and I mean, Lordy, that's a whole nother episode. That is so rich, because if we're talking about body autonomy, and I want my kid to feel autonomous, and I want them to feel that they have power and control over their body, it doesn't just start when they're 15. It starts when they're little, and it starts around food. And so if I want my kid to be in a situation where they are feeling nervous around their creepy soccer coach or their friend's older sibling, their body is sending them messages that I feel a little bit uncomfortable. I feel a little bit nervous. Something is kind of going off in my brain that this person is a little bit dangerous or a little bit too familiar. I don't like how they're rubbing my back all the time. All of those moments, they start, right? Like, it has to start somewhere where we're teaching them to feel empowered over their body and what happens to their body. And we're teaching them to listen to their body. And so I'm constantly saying, when my kids express a feeling or an emotion, where do you feel that in your body? Or how do you know that in your body? Or what is your body telling you to communicate that? Oh, I feel bubbles in my tummy. Oh, okay. That's interesting. Maybe we could put our hand on our tummy and just see what that does or whatever. But it's the same thing with food. And I think what makes me feel so passionate about this is, you know, all the work that you and I've done with kids around sexual abuse, there has to come a point where your kid starts to learn to listen to their body, because that is how they will know when they feel unsafe or they are in a moment with someone that something doesn't feel right. Either you're bullying me and you're being kind of mean the way that you're speaking to me, or I'm feeling unsafe and this, you know, creepy back rubbing is like going on a little bit too long. We want to be teaching them to listen to your body. What's your body telling you? Because that is how they will then be safe. Again, when you are not around and they are in the presence of other people and other adults, I want them to trust themselves and have that autonomy that they are allowed to say, something feels weird in my body. I can't put my finger on it, but I'm going to get out of here. I'm going to leave this room. I'm going to go find a grown-up. I'm going to go find someone else. I'm going to whatever. But that food is a great way that you can be starting that conversation and teaching them about autonomy, but it has to start. You can't have both. You can't have a kid who's 12 and super body autonomy and I feel uncomfortable in my body. I'm going to leave this room and keep my body safe. You don't start there. It starts with stuff like, how many cupcakes are you having at the birthday party? And are you going to have 20 gummy lollies or whatever? It has to start with parents trusting their kids more around food. I mean, I feel like I sound crazy when I'm drawing that connection, but I really believe it, that there is a connection there of teaching kids to trust themselves and us trusting them in making those choices around food and their body, and a connection to body autonomy down the track and getting into tricky situations.
Yeah. And I think, you know, my past mentor, she said, and it's always stayed with me, that the way we relate to food parallels the way we relate to ourselves. And so that is kind of what you're talking about, I think, is like when it comes to food, creating flexibility and safety and autonomy and body trust rather than rigidity, yeah. judgment, yeah. all or nothing thinking, perfectionism, yeah. you know? So it is true that I do deeply believe that the way we relate to food is the way we relate to ourselves. And when we start changing that, magic can happen.
Totally.
Yeah. Totally. The last thing I'll say for parents, because I think it's really important, is normalize body diversity. So, you know, you think about, even just think of your own childhood for your listeners, think of the images of bodies that you saw growing up that we see in the media. It's changing a little bit now, but you know, for us, it's thin, white, able-bodied. And I mean, tiny, right? Like for us, it was, I think they call it heroin chic, like very tiny. And so, you know, we really want to start normalizing with our kids that body size is just as diverse as our eye color, as our hair color, as our skin color, as our height, right? And that there's nothing wrong with that. And it's normal for our bodies to change. The number of women I work with that think that they're supposed to stay at the same weight that they were in high school, right, as a child, is absurd. And so it's normalizing. It's great that bodies are different. There's diversity here. And it's normal that our bodies will change and grow, right? And so that's a really good one with kids.
Yeah. And I think too about like aging and wrinkles. That's a whole nother situation. But that whole thing about our aging is not okay. And the relationship that we have to wrinkles, and that again, back to the body, is so important, and how it looks is so important. I've been reading, I don't know if you've heard of it, You Belong by Sabine Selassie. Highly recommend. It's super, super good. But I was just listening to that book yesterday, and she was talking about wrinkles and Botox and stuff, and how, yeah, women aren't allowed to age, and how our body is just the host of our worth and our value, is what society would say. Back to body diversity. One of the things that you taught me that I found really helpful, and I think our listeners would find really helpful too, is, well, how do I describe it when my kid sees someone who is a different weight or stature or just in a different body? How do I describe that? Or what do I do when my kid calls someone fat? I don't want to teach them that fat is bad, but I also want to say,
don't say that.
How do I handle that? And one of the things you taught me was saying someone in a bigger body is how I could describe someone's body, is saying that person is in a bigger body. And I know that some people might be rolling their eyes and laughing at like, oh my gosh, that just sounds so politically correct. And like, so what, I'm not allowed to say fat? And I think it's just sort of this difficult point of like, okay, so I don't want to be fat phobic, right? But I want to be an ally, but then I don't want to use the word fat. So is saying fat okay? Is not saying fat okay? What language do I give my kids? You know what I mean? It just feels a bit like, so what am I supposed to say? What am I not supposed to say if I'm trying to be an ally in this space?
Well, I think I honestly think some of that is further into a healing process, right? So if we've unlearned some things and we've unpacked some things, like there is this whole movement that in the fat positive community that, and within, in terms of advocacy, is that fat is not a bad word. It is a neutral descriptor. Right. And so it's okay to say fat. And the thing with kids is, it's, to me, I find it a bit tricky of, I want them to know fat is not a bad word. Right. And that it's okay to be fat. Fat people deserve respect. They deserve the same medical care as everyone else. Right. We could go on that, like that, but where I find it tricky with kids is it's used as an insult, yes. right? And kind of to bully. And so yeah,
Paige is almost eight, and she has a friend at school who gets called chubby all the time. And she was asking me what that meant, and you know, why were they saying that? And then now this year she's told me that it's evolved into fat, and saying this friend of hers is fat. And she's like, she wasn't necessarily asking me like, what do I say or what do I do? She didn't articulate it that way, but she was more telling me like, you could tell there was this sense of her of like, it's not okay, because she saw how it made her friend feel. She saw that it made her sad. So what I said was, you know, we don't comment on people's bodies. I've been telling them that since they were two, that we don't comment on people's bodies. And one of her friends who's really short, she hates it when people say, oh, you're so little and so cute and I could just pick you up. And Paige said, to this kid's defense, we don't talk about people's bodies, because she knew her friend didn't like being called short or that being commented on. And so she said in her defense, it's not cool to talk about people's bodies. And I was like, yeah, man. But it's like translating that then to weight. How do we do that? Like, how do we, do you know what I mean? It's like, how do we say, you know what I mean?
I do. And I don't necessarily know if I have the answer, as much as I think it can be maybe nuanced conversation of, that hurts so-and-so's feelings. We want our kids to develop empathy, but we can create a home space where fat's not a bad word, right? Like, it's tall, short, fat, thin, like, and you know,
purple, green, yellow. Yeah.
And I'm still learning in this area too. And there is, so her name's Aubrey Gordon, and listening to her audiobook right now, and it's called What We Don't Talk About When We Talk About Fat. And so Aubrey Gordon is a good one. And you know, when it comes to this, especially, like, I like to learn from people with lived experience, and some of it's lived experience I don't necessarily have. And so I would definitely recommend her work. Yeah.
So with giving ourselves language, like as adults, if I was, say, trying to describe someone, I'm trying to think of an example of where I would need to, how do we say that? Like, they're in a bigger body, they're, you know, cause I feel like saying, like, we can say they're in a wheelchair, they're on crutches, she has long hair, you know, like, oh, my friend is just meeting me, she'll be here in a minute, she has brown hair, you know, or I don't know. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like, how should we use it? Like, what's the language? Like, just that, like, have a bigger body, they're tall, they're short, whatever, you know, like, I think a lot of people will say to me, I don't know what I'm supposed to do then. So it's like, how am I supposed to talk about this? In my own head, how am I supposed to view it? And I guess maybe the place to start is just being aware of, when I think of fat, what comes up in my head? And can I just bring some awareness and some mindfulness to what do I think when I see someone who's gained weight since the last time I saw them? What pops up in my head?
Yeah.
Or someone who's lost weight. Do I need to comment on that? Do I need to say something? What's that about? Why do I feel that need, that urge that comes up, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know the answers about what word, like I've said, I think fat can be a neutral descriptor, but I think what you started to say is more important, of rather than kind of get in our heads about what's right and what's wrong, like, that is kind of coming back to curiosity and empathy. And yeah, the, you know, if we see someone and go, oh, she shouldn't be wearing that because she's fat, that is some of our own fat phobia coming up. And it's a process to become aware of that, unpack it, understand it. And that's why I'm saying, I think learning from fat creators and fat activists is where to go for that. And so another one, let me just pull up her Instagram quickly, because their name is Vinny and they are fierce.fatty on Instagram. And so, yeah, I think I would back away from right and wrong, bad and good language, and come back to openness, curiosity, awareness, and start learning from these, like from fat people about their experience.
And realizing, I think that the way that we've been taught, the way that we've been conditioned, what our family of origin, our culture, our advertising, the marketing, all of that crap, where it comes from, who's behind it, what are they gaining? What are they going to, you know, financially, what are they going to get out of
it? My favorite question is when I have a thought, go, who's profiting from this right now?
Totally. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who's making money off me feeling bad about my skin or the whiteness of my teeth or the wrinkles on my forehead? Who profits from this shame or doubt in myself? 100%. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, dude, I could talk to you forever. What is maybe a summary or a takeaway that you want to, the note you want to end on, or anything that we've missed that you really felt like pressing on your heart that you wanted to say, or what's your takeaway?
I mean, I think I would want listeners to just like give yourselves permission to be curious about this stuff. That I really do think that's the first place to start. Curious of my beliefs around my body, curious around where my relationship really is with food, curious about what I've learned about thinness and fatness. And then kind of following your heart. And it might not feel comfortable. Like it doesn't, it might not be unicorns and rainbows, but kind of following your heart as to if we've talked about a book or a podcast, you know, podcast that we've talked about, or, you know, I think just being open. And like I said, I do think it's pretty difficult to support your children through this if you haven't done some of the work on yourself first. In terms of like, if you have a listener who's kind of clicked with some of what I've said, I'm on Instagram and I'm at Vanessa_Preston_. I'm most active on Instagram. I'm also on Facebook. And then my website is greenlifepsychology.com. And I do have a page for my body and food freedom group where you can read more, you can apply for the program. And so, yeah, I think that would be my parting words is follow some fat creators, keep an open mind and heart, stay curious. I would hate for someone to go into some spin of anxiety about like what's right or what's wrong or what they've done wrong, more kind of just stepping back of that curious compassion piece first.
And the thing that I would say about your program too, and why I recommend so many of my clients to do it is, it's handholding. It's not overwhelming. You know, like you will step people through slowly, compassionately, gently, in a non-shamey way, unpacking like basically everything that we've spoken about. You help sort of like you're the guide on the path, on the trek, you know, that you guide people through unpacking this stuff and making sense of it. So it doesn't feel overwhelming. And it doesn't feel like I'm letting go of all of my control and all of the sort of safety I've always found in food and exercise. And Vanessa's going to take that all away from me. It's like, no. It's super slow and it's super gradual. And it's just a process, I think, of gathering more information to make all of this stuff make sense that we've just spoken about. Is that right? Is that accurate?
Yeah. And it's trauma informed, right? So much of body food stuff is ways that we've tried to like seek safety, seek connection, regulate our nervous system. And so I am not about to create a program that yanks the rug out from under you, you know? And so it's very trauma informed, which does mean big emphasis on gradual and safe. The group, they always end up being so beautifully supportive of each other. And in terms of kind of the structure, it's over 16 weeks and it's kind of broken up into three parts. And the first part really is safely reconnecting, starting to reconnect to our body, learning shame resiliency and self-compassion work. Then we go principle by principle with intuitive eating, and then we move into the body healing stuff. And I've created the body food freedom. So I call it BFF. So I've created the BFF graduates because I found that once women go through the program, they go, oh my gosh, I want to stick with this community, right? because some of what I've talked about today is not mainstream. It's countercultural. And so, you know, I have that to kind of continue this involvement in a community where you can keep learning. So yeah, I love what I do. It's exciting. And I think, like I said, we've talked about like these big, broad kind of issues today. And I hope your listeners don't feel overwhelmed.
Yeah, I think it's good though to cover a broad spectrum of stuff so people see that there's so much more to it. It's not just about eating celery and going for a run. Like there's
Exactly. It's not a meme on social media that says, I started listening to my hunger and all my problems were solved. Like that's not it.
Yeah. It's not a silver bullet.
It's not.
The thing that I just think is cool is that your program gets them from A to B, right? There's a transformation that takes place.
Yeah.
And especially when we're like, I don't know where to start, or culturally, my culture would not be okay with what you're saying, lady. But knowing that you then have this little bubble, this little safe space that you can go to each week in the program to help unlearn and then relearn and get clear on a lot of things. And then at the end, to be free. Oh my gosh, to be free in my disordered eating, to be free from the way that I view my body, punish it, the way that I view exercise, the way, just all of that stuff, to know that at the end of this program, I will be free of that stuff. And to know that sometimes I've said to parents, if you're not going to do it for you, do it for your kid, man. Like, because you don't want your daughter to have the same relationship with food in her body, like do it for her. And then some moms are like, okay, that hooked me. I'll do it for her. And then throughout the process, they've done it for themselves and they've realized, you know, it's a gift you're giving yourself and it's a gift you're giving your kids and then future generations, you know? Yeah. So,
and maybe we do another episode where we can dive into parts of this more specifically, but something that came to my head that I want listeners to know before we wrap up is in the program, I teach body neutrality. And so this is a thing that people get confused about, that body image work has to be like, I love my body. And actually that's not at all what we're moving towards. And I find that actually quite unhelpful. It's moving toward from body violence, which can be punitive exercise, that can be eating disorder behavior, that can be self-harm, to body hatred, and then to body neutrality, where we work on feeling more neutral about our body. We focus on how it helps us. It's a vehicle to engage with our life. We don't have to love what it looks like, but we certainly can develop compassion and gratitude for it. And then hopefully towards body respect and body acceptance. But that's kind of what I mean, is it's gradual. It's not, and yeah, anybody thinking like, I'm never going to get where I love my body, you don't have to.
Yeah. That's not the goal. That's not the end point.
No.
Yeah. 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 Oh, thank you, my dear. That was
fun.
Thank you.
That was so good.
Hang out.
And your cat made me laugh.
So you said where everyone can find you if they want to hook up and connect with you and follow you. And we'll put the rest in the show notes. And I think if anyone has any follow-up questions, to seek Vanessa or I out on social or email or whatever.
Yeah.
And we can answer any further questions. And thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Heidi.
If you're a parent or a professional who works with children and you want my help in improving things with the kiddos in your life, or if you're simply a human being feeling kind of stuck and maybe kind of overwhelmed, my online programs have lots of resources, transformative content, one-on-one coaching, group coaching, and a supportive community. If you want to learn more, just go to HeidiRogers.com. All right, friends, thank you as always for tuning in today. Our time is our most precious asset, so I truly appreciate you sharing your time with me. I'll see you right back here for the next episode of Tell the Others.